Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Dr. Rhiannon Evans, Senior Lecturer in Classics and Ancient History from La Trobe University. This is episode CVII, The Legacy of Spartacus. When we last left Spartacus, he'd amassed an army and had some victories against the Romans. While he was ultimately unsuccessful, the story of his rebellion against oppressors would grow and find a sympathetic audience in the modern time. Here's Rhiannon Evans.
So the Senate were very concerned about the many successes of Spartacus at this point and the way that he had fought against the Roman military, and they needed a way to respond. Sending consuls wasn't enough, so they had to find somebody else, and the person that they found was Marcus Licinius Crassus, who had been known as a general who'd had great success in the civil war between Sulla and Marius. And he was a Sullan through and through. He was on the side of the aristocracy, the Senate, so he's popular with them because of that, and he's also had proven success.
So you've got somebody of the right pedigree and somebody with a good track record leading military and having victories. So I take it once your consuls are defeated, you look for a hero, or you look for who Rome can brand as a hero.
Yeah, and there were a couple of other candidates. And in fact, at first, Crassus says, oh, I want these other people to help me. And the big names that come up are Pompeius Magnus, Pompey the Great, and Lucullus, who had also been a successful general in that period. But pretty soon after that, Crassus regrets it because he wants all the glory for himself. So he does his best to keep them out, to get it all finished before they arrive. Crassus's behavior throughout shows us just how double-edged this whole servile war was, that it will give him great authority if he can put it down, but at the same time, it's not quite the same as defeating a foreign enemy.
Yeah, I find it interesting how you've gone through that change, whereas before, when Spartacus first escaped and when he started rallying slaves around him, it was like, you know, Crassus would have gone, no, I don't want to go there. I don't want to engage with
this
slaves.
This isn't good enough for me.
Or, you know, this is quite beneath me. I don't want to be seen being the person who cleans up this mess. Whereas now it's a real formidable threat to Rome.
Yes. So he can be seen as the savior of Rome. Even if he can't claim a triumph at the end of it, Rome will have to be grateful to him. This will actually be really good for his reputation. So he kind of rules towards the end of the 70s because he's the man who comes in and saves Rome.
Double-edged sword, though, it's also great PR for Spartacus that they're sending somebody like this up against him.
Yeah, that he's now such a force to be reckoned with that they need to go find their best men, their best leaders. But, you know, Rome is desperate at this point.
So what kind of man is Crassus then? What kind of leader is he?
He's really tough. You would not want to go up against him. And you wouldn't want to be troops under him either, because he inherits the troops who have been defeated by Spartacus, right? The two consuls have to give up their troops to him. He gets some additional ones as well. He regards them as being cowardly. And the traditional, it was very traditional and considered very harsh punishment that the Romans could impose upon their armies was decimation, which is a word we use inaccurately. DEC meaning 10, and it means you kill every 10th man as a punishment and a warning to the others, whether they were the cowardly ones or not. So it's at random. So Appian tells us, quote, when he arrived at his destination, he received also the two legions of the consuls, whom he decimated by lot for their bad conduct in several battles. Some say that Crassus too, having engaged in battle with his whole army and having been defeated, decimated the whole army and was not deterred by their numbers, but destroyed about 4,000 of them.
That seems harsh.
Decimation always seems harsh.
Yeah, okay. To our modern ears, killing 1/10 of your men randomly by lot seems harsh. To a Roman, it's not. But excessively just killing all 4,000 of them because they lost a battle, is that because it was, in particular, a battle against slaves?
Yeah, I imagine so. I mean, there is evidence of decimation being practiced and being effective, probably so, of the next battle being won gloriously. I think Plutarch is saying to us that Crassus's action is very harsh here, though. I think he's teeing us up to think, even as an ancient reader, if we were around at the time of Plutarch, that this is extreme, that this shows a kind of I don't know whether he quite wants us to see it as a knee-jerk reaction, as an angry reaction, as something that is exaggerated, over the top, out of proportion to the situation. Because Plutarch's, I get the impression here, he's not saying that decimation itself is something that should never happen, but the fact that you do it to the whole army, normally you do it to a particular cohort or maybe a legion.
Just to make an example.
Cowardly.
Yeah. So this isn't just to make an example, this is just wide-scale punishment.
Mm. Yeah. It seems that way. It makes me think that Crassus is being presented as angry here, as not being in control of his emotions. This is not a particularly positive representation.
I feel if they made the Spartacus movie again, they'd have this scene.
Yeah, and I think you're right. I mean, the film has a lot of extras, and Laurence Olivier playing Crassus is truly evil. So it's quite surprising that they didn't choose this truly evil action.
Mm. To show that this was a man who needed to be taken down by slave rebels. Yeah.
But wouldn't be.
So what strategy is Crassus working with then? He wants more than glory. He wants a good outcome.
Well, he goes after Spartacus, and I suppose in some ways he's quite lucky. And I think Plutarch tells us that Crassus is a kind of combination of very astute and lucky, because Spartacus is now heading south. And again, the geography of Italy comes into play, because if he carries on heading south, then he can be trapped there.
Yeah.
Only the sea is his escape. He's also clearly got a good force that he makes fight well, because immediately he comes up against a smaller part of Spartacus's army of about 10,000 men and has a victory over them. So there's a kind of raising of morale on the Roman side, and presumably lowering of morale for Spartacus's side, that after all this string of victories, now they've been defeated. Even if it's by this point it's estimated that Spartacus had 120,000 followers, so a 12th of that have been defeated. Still, it's not a good feeling for the slave army.
So Spartacus's intentions in going further south, does he have a plan at all?
Very hard to know. He sort of gets cornered into it. I almost feel like he's going back to what he knows. He came from the south of Italy. That's where it started. He's heading back there now. That's his, in as much as he has one, his power base. And he's doesn't seem to have had the stomach for going for Rome. You almost feel like it's one of those if only he'd just headed for the Alps and gone to Gaul, maybe he'd have got away.
Mm.
But no, he's headed the wrong way. He's headed south, and he can be trapped there, and that is what happens.
So he gets trapped in, like, essentially the toe of Italy, doesn't
exactly.
he? The toe of the boot.
Yes. It's a very narrow strip of land, and basically he's trapped on that peninsula. So he has to stand and fight, or he has to get out.
But is he trying to get out at all?
He does seem to have, at least according to Plutarch, tried to commandeer some ships to get him over to Sicily. So Plutarch says, at the Straits, he chanced upon some Cilician pirate craft, so a ship, and determined to seize Sicily by throwing 2,000 men into the island. I like the translation throwing, like he really just lobbed them over there. He thought to kindle anew the servile war there, which had not long been extinguished and needed only a little additional fuel.
So he's got a strategy here. He's gone down there for that reason?
Yeah. Well, he's trapped there.
Yeah.
But still, he's got a way out.
So it's while I'm here.
Yeah. And, you know, it is a very short distance between the toe of Italy and Messina in Sicily. This is him fighting on, even though he can't get out, at least can't get out via Italy.
Mm.
And this is from Frontinus on escaping a difficult situation, but it's not found anywhere else. When Marcus Crassus had constructed a ditch around the forces of Spartacus, the latter at night filled it with the bodies of prisoners and cattle that he had slain, and thus marched across it.
It's a great tactic.
It's so gory. It's great, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's so Spartacus as well. This is Spartacus propped dead men up with spears kind of Spartacus to make it look like there's actually men behind the wall.
It's very ad hoc and clever.
Yeah. And resourceful in a gruesome way.
Resourceful. And probably meant to be a sign of him. He hasn't come out of traditional military training, although according to one source, he has been through the Roman army.
Yeah.
But maybe that means he understands them, but he doesn't have to think like them.
Mm. Mm.
It's a mark of genius. It'd be nice if it were elsewhere, because it's hard to substantiate.
Yes.
It's not in Appian or anywhere else.
He's really backed into a corner at this point.
It's siege time now, and he doesn't seem to want to, but his troops are building walls and ditches, which is what you do when you're under siege. So they're sort of they're creating a ditch across the top of the toe of Italy, and creating this space for themselves there where they can exist and ward off the Romans, hopefully.
So since Plutarch is chronicling the story of Crassus and this is his big victory, I suppose that we know a lot about this event from Crassus's point of view. We know the Crassus highlights.
Yeah, at this point, Appian gives us pretty much an overview, whereas Plutarch gives us a little bit more detail. Even so, Plutarch seems interested in what's going on amongst the slave army too. So, you know, from here on in, I'm sorry to tell you, it's a series of defeats for the slave army. And in one of those early victories for Crassus, Plutarch is still telling us about the slaves. He tells us that Crassus's troops killed 12,300 slaves. It's very precise. Mm. And that only two of them were wounded in the back. So they all stood there and fought. Plutarch's very interested in making these slaves appear quite noble. They're not cowardly. They don't just run. But Spartacus does run at this point. He retreats to the mountains. And there are some minor successes against a small detachment of Romans. But Plutarch actually says this is a bad thing in a way because this was his ruin, says Plutarch. It gives them confidence. But Crassus is very, very determined because this is the point where he knows that Pompey's on his way. Pompey has been recalled. And he could actually come and take some of the glory. Crassus does not want that.
Crassus wants to wind it all up quickly.
He does.
Yeah.
Appian also says at this point, doesn't come up in Plutarch, but he says that Spartacus tried to come to terms with Crassus. In other words, he tried to make a peace agreement.
Right.
This would be a foolish thing to attempt. Crassus is not going to make a treaty with slaves. He would consider it so beneath him.
When it looks like a certainty that he's going to win at this point.
Well, he's in the ascendant, really. Yeah. He's got very little to gain by making a peace treaty, or very little to lose by carrying on fighting. So that looks like desperation if it did happen.
So I suppose for the final finale, you want a scene where Crassus confronts Spartacus on the battlefield, which probably never happened.
Well, unfortunately, we don't get that final duel, and I'm sure if we had, then Plutarch at the very least would have told us about it. The two accounts in Plutarch and Appian aren't exactly the same, but we do get the idea that Spartacus keeps fighting until the end. So Spartacus goes on foot. He's supposed to have killed his horse, saying, I don't need one now. I'm going to stand on my feet and fight.
So big dramatic gesture. Mm. Yeah.
And if I win, I'll have plenty of horses. I don't need this one. After having been so underconfident around Rome, that seems like a very overconfident statement, or I don't know, maybe desperation. He's supposed to have killed two centurions, so two very high up officers. And according to Plutarch, he ends up standing alone in the middle of corpses of his fellow fighters, fighting until the end, until he's cut down. Then, pushing his way towards Crassus himself through many flying weapons and wounded men, he did not indeed reach him, but slew two centurions who fell upon him together. Finally, after his companions had taken to flight, he stood alone, surrounded by a multitude of foes, and was still defending himself when he was cut down. Actually, I take it back about him not being heroic at all, because that is a very heroic death scene.
That's a great death scene. He's really going out in a glorious way.
And it is very cinematic, isn't it? There are so many ways we would change that film. Because, of course, the film ends with him on a cross, which is a different kind of symbolic ending.
Yeah, I'd rather this ending.
But the fact that he's going for his real opponent, we're almost getting this duel between the two big guys that we want. He doesn't get there, but he kills two other important commanders on the way anyway.
Mm.
It is giving him some stature, certainly at this point. So we've seen that he can be very clever all the way along. He's got a lot of physical bravery. I think it's a bit of an old-fashioned phrase, but that's what this ending shows, this fortitude that he will just get in there amongst it, that he'd keep going until the end. Appian says it's slightly less dramatic, that Spartacus is wounded in the thigh, not a fatal injury, and then sinks to his knees, but continues fighting until he's overcome. Appian says his body was never found, which I guess makes it more tragic in a way. Although the Romans would not have given him any kind of dignified burial, you can be sure.
But then again, if his body is never found, he maybe was never killed.
Well, yes, it could lead to rumours like that. I don't think, or at least not in the sources we've got, there continue to be rumours that Spartacus might be, you know, living in Sicily somewhere.
So writing it this way, is Plutarch stealing the victory in some ways from Crassus? by giving Spartacus such a glorious end?
It's a glorious end, but ultimately the Romans still win, don't they? And I guess, I think you're right, though. It does steal some of the limelight from Crassus, and some of that might be about the fact that Plutarch is very clear that Crassus didn't deserve all the glory anyway, because Pompey was very annoyed with Crassus about Crassus taking all of the glory. He felt he deserved some of it. So this is a quote from Plutarch. Although Crassus had been fortunate, he had shown most excellent generalship and exposed his person to danger. So he's brave.
Yes.
Nevertheless, his success did not fail to enhance the reputation of Pompey. For the fugitives from the battle encountered that general and were cut to pieces, so he could write to the Senate that in open battle, indeed, Crassus had conquered the slaves, but that he himself had extirpated the war.
Wow, so Crassus didn't even get to finish the war.
No, and of course, I like to think that this isn't just Plutarch's rhetoric, that Pompey says that this is his way of cutting Crassus down to size.
Yeah.
You know, he killed some slaves, but I finished the war. Mm-hmm. So it really moves the emphasis there from slaves who are nothing to Romans to being a victor in war. It'd be nice to have some speeches of Pompey and think that that might have been a sign of the way he harangued the people.
How big a victory is it for Crassus?
It's a huge victory. It's a huge coup. It's very important for his authority, but it's not a victory for which he can claim a triumph, in other words, the parade, because he would have to march foreign troops in there, and these are slaves, and that's beneath his dignity. So he claims something slightly below a triumph called an ovation, which means that his troops pay him honor, but he's going to have to go get his triumph somewhere else. A while after this, he'll try and get that glory by going east to Parthia, and that will be his undoing. Because that's where he dies, loses three legions.
He takes a lot of slaves prisoner.
Yes. So a lot of them are picked off and killed, but 6,000 are taken prisoner, but they're not marched in a triumph. They are put up on crosses along the main road from Rome to where it all started in Capua, called the Appian Way. 6,000 crucifixions along the Appian Way is a message to slaves that you do not do this again.
So as a result of this, Rome really secures itself with its slaves, doesn't it? It really cements how the status quo is going to be.
Well, we sort of have the argument of silence here in that there are no more slave wars. There are no more slave rebellions. So slaves will continue to run away and rebel in their individual ways, but they don't collect together and fight against Rome.
So how about Spartacus himself, though? How does he become a symbol throughout time, because he's always going to be the slave that you can hold up and say, this guy made a stance against things. Other slaves could do the same. So for some, he could be a symbol. For others, he could be a warning.
I mean, apart from the sources we've got, the historical sources and the biography of Crassus, we don't know that he is mentioned elsewhere in antiquity. We don't know if slaves were whispering his name and thinking of him as a hero. It would be nice to think that. But he becomes a symbol for later generations, sort of centuries later, of any kind of resistance of the oppressed. So his name means that you are rising up against tyranny or authority or slavery itself in some instances. In a rebellion against the French in what later becomes Haiti, a figure called Toussaint Louverture was known as, or at least called by the opposition, the Black Spartacus. So while Spartacus could be used by people who are mounting a rebellion as a symbol of trying to end that oppression, from the point of view of the people in authority, you can see that Spartacus was still seen as a negative figure, somebody who's just causing trouble and needs to be put down. So it kind of depends where you are in the system of power as to whether you regard him as a positive or a negative. Apparently Marx regarded him as one of the great heroes of history. And you can see from a Marxist point of view, he's very much a hero, but he could also be seen as just a troublemaker.
And in a modern context, I suppose the greatest association that we've got with Spartacus is with how he's been co-opted by Hollywood and the media, isn't it?
Yeah, well, there was a novel written in the early 1950s by Howard Fast, and that was then developed into a film. It's not the first film about Spartacus. There were some Italian films earlier on, but it's certainly the most famous one, made by Stanley Kubrick in 1960 and starring Kirk Douglas. But being made in 1960, it's often seen as a film that put out at a time when the civil rights movement in America is gathering pace. And it makes direct reference to that, because while Spartacus is white, he's Kirk Douglas, he's kind of the American hero, he has a close colleague called Draba, who's an invented character, he's not in the ancient sources, who's black. And the two of them are actually pitted against each other by Nastio Laurence Olivier, who's playing Crassus, in a duel. Again, this is not from any of the ancient sources at all. This is before he's broken out. This is one of the reasons he breaks out and starts a slave revolt, is they're told they have to fight each other to the death, and they are friends. And Draba actually has Spartacus on the ground with a trident at his throat, but he won't kill him. He takes the trident and throws it at Laurence Olivier, misses him, and then gets his throat slit by Crassus. And his body then hangs upside down in the gladiator quarters as a warning to them. And this sacrifice on the part of the black man is a sort of symbol of why Spartacus has to fight, I suppose, because there's so much oppression there. But the fact that they've chosen a black actor to do that plays into this being about civil rights. I mean, it was made in 1960, so if you haven't seen it yet, then I don't feel like I'm giving away spoilers. But it has a much more dramatic ending, even than Spartacus being cut down on the battlefield on his own, in that he is one of the crucified along the Appian Way at the end. So he's one of the 6,000. He's left there on the cross, which of course makes him a Christ-like figure as well.
Yeah.
And he's visited by his love interest, Verinia, which seems to be a name that's made up from Verinius, one of Spartacus's early opponents, strangely enough. It's the female form of that name. Not quite sure what's going on there. And she holds up their baby. They have a baby son. And she says, he's a free man, Spartacus, which always makes me cry because their child is not a slave.
Yeah.
So he's kind of won, even as he's dying on the cross. All entirely invented, but a brilliant ending, I think.
So Spartacus has clearly become more than what he was at the time. He's become a symbol that can be used conveniently.
Well, in a way, the film has taken on a life of its own, and it's the most famous version of Spartacus, quite rightly. And it's partly because of that scene where we see unity with Spartacus himself. So the slaves have been defeated, and I'm sure you know the scene I mean, where they ask, which of you is Spartacus? They're going to pick him out and make an example of him. Spartacus identifies himself, but then somebody else says, I am Spartacus. And they're all at the end shouting, I am Spartacus, which is another bit of the film that gets me teary, because it's the idea that they're all standing for this same thing. It's absolutely not what the ancient sources tell us at all, but that they've got this bigger movement. They've got this ideology. They've got this opposition to oppression, and that is represented by Spartacus. So in that way, they are all Spartacus.
These changes to the narrative then, or at least these embellishments to the narrative, really show us how we view independence differently, I suppose, and how we view slaves differently to how they were viewed in the ancient sources. In the ancient sources, the best one that we've got, the story is all about Crassus, whereas now the story is about Spartacus and about freedom and liberation.
Exactly. I mean, Plutarch, although at times he makes Spartacus heroic figure in some ways, a noble figure anyway. He's writing biography of Crassus. He would never think about writing a biography of Spartacus. That wouldn't even occur to him. I mean, he doesn't write biographies of any women, let alone of a slave. Whereas now, yes, the film is called Spartacus. It's not called Crassus. So even though Plutarch does show some interest in Spartacus and his way of thinking, his strategy, and a glorious death, as we saw, we have changed the way that we see this story. We've made it about Spartacus, not so much about Crassus. Mm-hmm. We're not as interested in the elite, the entitled aristocracy, as the man who tried to fight for liberty to overturn this system. And that, I guess, is a very 20th century, or certainly post-18th century view of the world. It's not something really that could have been written before that point, where we're interested in the underclass, in the individual. The Romans are just glad to have put down the slaves.
That's Dr. Rhiannon Evans, Senior Lecturer in Classics and Ancient History at La Trobe University, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe to it in Apple Podcasts and your local friendly neighbourhood podcatching service. As always, please leave a review, they are muchly appreciated. You can give The Emperors of Rome a like on Facebook, and you can follow both myself and Rhiannon Evans on Twitter. Can you tell this is my fourth attempt at this voiceover? Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon Evans, and I am at Nightlight Guy. That's it today for Emperors of Rome. So until the next episode, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.